Hey, Caitlin.
Hi, Rebecca.
How are you?
You know, I went through the day thinking it was Thursday, the whole day, until my boss called me out in the middle of a meeting. So, how are you?
I would be happy if it was Thursday. I've been a little doom scrolling and everything else, which makes tonight actually a much better change in focusing on, you know, the Midwest. Instead of reading about everything that's going on, we get to talk to an amazing author who is located out that way. So, hey there, Lily.
Hi.
So we are here tonight with Lily Seabrook. And Lily, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So, hey, I'm Lily Seabrook. I am a lesbian romance author. I write new adult lesbian romance, and I'm active on Twitter, where I mostly just exist to spam the heart emoji at everyone on Twitter and tell everyone I love them. And there's not that much interesting about me. Pretty much all I do is write. I'm one of the only trans women in lesbian romance, and also just like in romance in general. So I guess that counts as kind of interesting. But yeah.
You are truly like a bright light on Twitter. I feel like I always see you being so supportive and so kind to everyone. And as someone who is not often kind to people, you inspire me to try to be nicer to strangers on the internet, because you were just so nice.
Yeah, I was going to say, not to say anything against what you just said, Lily, but I think you're lacking accolades about yourself is a little disheartening, because you're so good about making sure everybody around you is constantly lifted up for all the nuances that make them fantastic. So hopefully in the course of speaking to you tonight, Caitlin and I can sneak a couple in.
I mean,
and,
I did mention the heart emojis.
You did.
That is the most defining characteristic about me.
I have to also say you are a very gracious winner, because you have kicked my derriere many a time on Mario Kart. So you are very, very kind with the amount of, pardon my language, but ass kicking you do. So
if you get frustrated over Mario Kart, you'll never be satisfied.
Sounds like a line
that you took us to Baby Park a second time, but I can forgive you for that.
I believe I consistently came in last place when we played earlier this week with a group of other writers and readers. So, you know, I'm here to make sure everybody feels that they're superior to someone. So.
Extremely gracious of you.
Just kind of piggybacking off of what you talked about, I want to jump into your novels real fast, but you used a term that I feel is still new to many people, and you talked about how you were a new adult writer. Can you kind of go into what new adult means?
So new adult is, it sort of serves the bridge between young adults and adult romance. So it typically serves the more like closer to, I guess some people define it sort of like college age, where it tends to be in the range of like 18 to 25. So most of my protagonists are in their mid-20s, basically. That's where my books usually fall. Most adult romances tend to fall into the older age range, and mm-hmm. new adult is definitely, like you said, is much more of a new phenomenon to publishing in general, all across genres. So there's not a lot of space dedicated to new adult right now, but as the absolute baby in the lesbian community, I'm 26. I am extremely young. That is the sort of the niche that I've found myself falling into.
I don't want to call out anybody else's age in case they told me it in confidence. I can tell you personally, there's somebody in our circle that is younger than you. So, but if you want to stay the youngest, I will pretend I ignore those facts.
Yeah, I'm glad I have someone else. I'm not the only one that's weaning.
I am just smitten with your novels. And maybe part of it's because I think you allow younger people to still be young. And what I mean by that is you're kind of thrust in this thing once you hit 18 until you're, you know, considered somebody established, where you're just supposed to figure it out or fail. And you do this magnificent job with your characters, where you have people who are growing, but they're not, it's not a negative thing that they're in the trajectory of their growth and in figuring things out. Your plot isn't driven by just the act of being human being negative, which I find so incredibly refreshing. And I cannot hit hard enough for people to read your books because of that. I know you often describe your novels as kind of fluffy, but you still very much let the real world exist within them. Can I ask how you go about navigating that?
Honestly, I wish I could tell you, because then I'd be able to find out how to write novels more reliably. My entire writing process just involves like sitting down, writing 20,000 words and being like, was any of that any good? Or do I just have to throw it all out?
Okay, wait, time. We're coming. I want you to answer this, but 20,000 words in one sitting?
Not in one sitting.
Okay.
I mean, right. Sorry, I have back. Done that before. Whoa. I'm not going to do that again. Okay. I wanted to see if I could. The answer was yes. Was it a good idea? No.
Okay. So I apologize. I was just so bamboozled for a moment. So going back, so you sit down, you write. I worked for a director at one point who used to ask playwrights who came in, when they are writing, what is on the, where are they? What is in the space with them? And what do they need to feel comfortable while they write? So where are you? What's with you? And what do you absolutely need when you're writing?
Typically, I'm sitting in bed.
Okay.
And typically, I have a cup of coffee. And typically, I say typically, but this one's like 99.98% of the time, I take 30 minutes at a time of pure uninterrupted writing time, and I will just turn out whatever is on my mind. No editing, no backspacing, no backing up, and no changing anything that I put down, just going forwards. And that makes up almost all of the writing that I do.
Rebecca and I are silent with jealousy right now.
I mean, I write full time, so
yeah.
I don't have interruptions in my life. It is a very nice way to spend my time, and appropriately, I do get a lot of writing done. Like, I wrote 10,000 words today, so.
Congratulations. That's huge.
It is. I'm a little tired, but you know, it's worth it.
I feel I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, the current thing that you're working on, is this the next thing that we will have the privilege to probably read?
Yes, I'm actually hoping very soon.
Okay.
I've been staying very quiet about it on Twitter and with everyone, because I found that the more I talk about my books in public settings, the more likely I am to jinx myself. So I just tend to, like, if I ever just go very, very quiet on social media, odds are that I'm just working really hard on a new book.
Okay. I also sometimes see you on social media, you know, just say you're taking like a mental health break, which I think is so incredibly admirable and sets such a wonderful pace for your peers and other writers to completely understand that, like, hey, look, this chaos is always going to be here. If you need to step back for a little while, like, you know, completely support yourself and do what you need to do for you. I think you set an amazing example frequently.
You weren't kidding about giving me a lot of compliments today, right?
Caitlin just laughs. She's so used to this at this point.
Yeah, it's Rebecca's specialty.
You're telling me that I'm the positive one who makes other people feel appreciated.
Well, I get the joy of, you know, just reading people's words. I'm not the one creating them. So it's very easy for me to gush because I take all the time. So I need to give back a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, the readers are what keep us doing what we do. So
speaking of like readers and the writing community, one thing that I love about sort of this world of books and the writers is the sense of community that is being built, especially I think among some of the younger or like up and coming writers. And one maybe negative aspect of that is I know a lot of you guys have your books on like Amazon and Goodreads. And so I guess my question is, what is that like, sort of having a mostly online community of readers, sort of a sometimes contentious field that is Goodreads, getting your work out in that way? And I guess my third question is, do you ever like read reviews or sort of engage with that aspect of being a writer online full time?
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to answer that third question first, because the third question is never. I do not read reviews. You could not pay me enough to read reviews. And so that is what makes the first questions. It's a lot mm-hmm. easier than you would think. I just don't think about it. I don't really engage with any of it. The only times I open Goodreads is to like get a link to put on my website or something. I put my books on there and then I walk away forever. honestly, my general approach to all of it is just the minimum I can get away with because, mm-hmm. you know, I like to just focus on the writing instead. So mm-hmm. I try to, the nice thing about Amazon, in my experience, is that it has a lot of algorithms that drive sales for me. And it handles a lot of recommending to new readers, finding readers for me, and mm-hmm. Making the sales to them without me actually having to do anything. So for my part, all I really have to do is, get into the community in the first place, be a part of the lesbian community, which just involves, scrolling around on Twitter, telling that I love them. And then the initial sales of my books are always inevitably regular lesbian readers. Mm-hmm. And that trains the Amazon algorithms. And so from that, all I have to do is step back because Amazon knows to just find other lesbian readers for my books and I don't have to do anything so to write the next book. So mm-hmm. I have set it all up to be as hands-off as possible. Extremely stress-free for me until I get to doom scrolling on Twitter because we are all vulnerable to that.
Yes, especially right now.
Especially right now.
Yeah. Well, my favorite question to ask in any of these interviews that we've done is why lesfic and what was the first piece of lesfic that you can remember reading and loving?
I have noticed that is your favorite question to ask. I know I'm calling the interviewers out. So my first lesfic novel was actually Forbidden Melody by mm-hmm. Magnolia Robbins, who is a dear friend of mine on Twitter. And that was back when it was published. So mid 2018. Thing is for me, I am a trans woman and mm-hmm. that on top of everything else already that makes grappling with your sexuality a complicated topic. Mm-hmm. And being trans on top of that makes things even more complicated than usual. So for me, it was a very long struggle coming to terms with that it's okay to be both transgender and a lesbian. Mm-hmm. I actually identified as bisexual up until 1 year ago because I sought out the potential to feel attracted to men. Mm-hmm. As a way of affirming my own female gender. So coming to terms with being a lesbian at all has been a difficult journey for me. And the reason that lesbic stuck with me was because it felt like just a free and open celebration of being a lesbian and mm-hmm. just women who love other women. And it offered a space for me that I was not able to find in my actual life. That is where being a woman attracted to other women is a natural thing, is a beautiful thing. And I was able to connect with in a way that, I think a lot of us had experience where we reread a lot of heterosexual books. Mm-hmm. That was what was out there and never really felt like what we were was actually a part of those stories. So that my first lesbian novel was a positive experience for me because it was able to help me affirm my own feelings. And from there, it actually kind of just sat in the back of my head for a year.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I'm still writing that whole time. I've been writing for a long time now. And a year later did suddenly something click and I'm like, I could just write that myself. Tried. I sat down and I turned out a novel in 5 days, which I have not recreated.
My gosh.
So I'm like, all right, apparently this works. It felt natural for me. It felt like I was actually putting in effort to avoid it all my life because I felt inherently like there was something wrong about embracing my own lesbianism. And now that I've actually been able to embrace it and find the community, find my books.
And I've noticed in your writing you have a lot of friends to lovers or sort of childhood crushes. So why that trope? And are there other sort of tropes that you might like to write or read more of in the future?
I did actually, I don't want to say too much about it because, you know, I don't jinx myself, but
no jinxing.
the current piece that I'm working on right now is also, and I was actually, because of that, I was thinking about it more often recently and why it is that I fall into those categories. And I think a lot of it actually does come back to my own experiences regarding love and romance as a transgender person, mm-hmm. where this might be a little heavy for a podcast, but oftentimes, even more than for gay people in general, the attractions of trans people are pathologized and mm-hmm. treated as something gross or unpleasant or socially unacceptable. And trans people, especially trans women, mm-hmm. are treated as like predators for even experiencing attraction for anyone. And so for me, I think it kind of comes from a place of that socialization where there needs to be a very solid base to build upon, and like the idea of being attracted to another person without some kind of long-standing connection with them that goes back mm-hmm. a ways just feels a little bit unusual to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's led me into tending towards friends to lovers, enemies to lovers, childhood crushes, and that kind of thing, where the main characters have some kind of connection from beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Lily, since you're talking about it, do you feel that your stories and your voice and you as an author and everything that makes you, which is plentiful and fantastic and amazing, is honored much more often than it's questioned at this current position in your authorship and your creation of stories? And what I mean by this is I think my Twitter feed and my internet persona is very curated to be involved and hear voices that affirm inclusion and this genre of work and a queer friendly space and a trans inclusive space. But I realize I've curated my feed to always look like that. And I can't help but also be aware that, you know, there's so much of my own cis privilege in being able to curate a community that I want to see, because I am in a position to find more people who mirror me or who are inclusive, because I'm already in a little bit more of a, I don't want to say a safer space. There's like no permission within my queerness, but I do see some representation of myself that isn't just, you know, trauma narratives, so to speak. I get to see myself be happy every once in a while. Do you find that you get to see that, or are you the person creating this so other people can see themselves?
I'm assuming you're talking about this in terms of transgenderism, transness.
Your transness, or just you as a young person finding, you know, love and being from, you know, not the left, you know, as they joke, the left coast or the upper, you know, northeast part of the U.S. There's so many things that I really have to remember that I sit in that isn't true for everybody else. And I think so many of us surround ourselves, you know, based on these coastlines in America and where we're located, based on our gender identity, based on our sexual sexual action and things like that. And you're being incredibly upfront and offering us an insight to a voice that is has been gatekeeped so much within our own community, and where Caitlin and I, you know, completely show up with wire cutters and try to cut down these gates, we still know that we have to back up and listen and be better. We can't just, you know, bum rush into everything. So with your honesty and your insight here, I was just hoping and wondering if you get to see yourself, because I feel that I pull back and I try to see you. But I've never really asked if you see yourself on the page, if you see yourself in the community.
As far as being a trans person, not really. Like, there is not a lot of trans representation in romance. That is changing recently. There's a lot of a lot more motion towards inclusive trans protagonists in stories. Still very young, very, very young trend, but it's increasing, and that's nice to see. I feel like the main issue is that there are not a lot of trans women in romance, and that means that we can't get a lot of own voices, trans feminine romance, because of that. But I feel like also, just in general, I feel like I am sort of a lesbian first and a trans woman second in terms of how I present, how I come across in my online presence. Like, I don't hide my transness, but I am much more active in my community of lesbianism than I am of transness. So I feel like that also reflects in my own perceptions of myself. Mm-hmm. Like, I do not see myself as immediately as a trans person as I do as being a lesbian. So I am probably not the best trans person to ask this, honestly, because
you are. Like, I mean, your story is of course the best story to ask because it's your story. Sorry, I don't have time for any erasure from you. I'm not going to stand for it. But as a cis person, I don't ever want to ask somebody, you know, to speak on behalf of an entire community. I guess my awkward question to you is, in the process of making sure, besides these works that you create, that we get to ingest and enjoy, and this amazing, and I mean this sincerely, this wonderfully kind version of yourself that you share with us and how you lift everybody else up around you, if we like it or not, we know that the lesbian community has not always been inclusive and is still working on being better about it. And I think in the process of watching somebody like yourself, who I've never heard say anything negative, and I'm not asking you to now, I hope you get to see other people so excited to talk to you and lift you up, and so glad we share this common space of women who love women and women who love women narratives and lesfic narratives, because I don't know a proper way to check in with you, nor do I ever want to draw attention to something because that will feel like othering as well. So I think just in listening to you, I know there are some people who will listen to this podcast and this will be the first time, like, they've really sat in some of their own thoughts and preconceived notions. And there will be other people who are so excited to hear a woman that is saying out loud the things they feel. And I know what it's like to be the one person in the room who ends up being an educator sometimes instead of a person. So I just want to make sure as we continue these conversations that you don't ever feel in this pod that you have to be an educator. If we ask any questions that are anything but supportive or, you know, just clarification, like, hold me accountable, teach me to, well, see there, I even said it there. Like, I'm not trying to make you educator, but, you know, just whatever language has to come up in the process of these conversations and this awkward doublespeak and even me tripping over myself now, I just know as a community, I know that I mess up and I want to be better, and I'm still learning how to do that and doing my own research, but you're so incredibly kind. I worry too that I will trip up and you will just be too gracious to kindly say, hey, Quirk, not, or there's my last name. Oops, you'll be too kind to say, you know, hey, Rebecca, I'm sure you had the best of intentions, but. So, yeah, I think all this trip over is, I'm so thankful you're saying these things. And of course, I want to ask you follow-ups, but I know it's also not your job to answer all those questions. So let's get back to your books, I guess.
I mean, honestly, like, I feel like there's kind of two things that trans people do. One or the other is that they'll either try to be perceived as cisgender and go what's called stealth, just like forget their transness and try to put it behind them, which is a wonderful thing to do. And I'm very happy for all the trans people who do that. Or they stay open about it, no matter how much they might pass as cisgender. They still want to be openly transgender and to let other people know that they are transgender. And for me, that is a lot of what I want in my own life, is to be openly transgender. And what I want to be able to do is to serve as a liaison to the trans community where possible, and provide a patient and understanding voice that can answer a lot of questions about transness in relation to other things. And so I really do not mind, like, I actively seek to put myself in that educator role for trans topics, for trans questions, because a lot of there's a lot of transphobia in the world, and most of it comes down to just that we're kind of rare. So, and even among those of us who are trans, which is already rare enough, some of us try not to be perceived as transgender. So it's very difficult to see and hear someone like me who can actually provide some familiarity, because familiarity is a beginning point of a lot of understanding and a lot of opening minds. So I do seek to be in that kind of educator position, because that lets me, that's how I like to support my trans community, is by being in that role because I'm comfortable with it, and by to help more cis people understand the trans experience.
You've worked as a sensitivity reader for a few authors, if I'm remembering correctly. I believe you just one. Was it TJ Dallas?
Yes.
On
yes, that's fine.
Okay. So sorry. All right. I obviously read TJ's work. But I know that TJ had done a call online asking for a secondary reader for her short additional bonus scene to her Pride trilogy, and you offered additional insight into Butterfly, which you can find on TJ's site, and we'll link beyond your work and our stuff as well. Is there a way for it? One, are you open to being a sensitivity reader? And then the second, if the answer is yes, is there a way in which to contact you or to properly approach you about having that insight?
I am open to it, yes. I did not think about, I mean, I guess I could just be DM'd on Twitter. If you want to, I mean, I should qualify. I am not, I'm very lazy. So I don't want to go through a manuscript just like all over the place. I have turned down requests for sensitivity reading before, just because I don't know the person, and it's kind of like, I'm not sure. I don't know if I feel comfortable going through with it, because sensitivity reading can be a very draining personal experience. And so I am open to sensitivity reading from people I trust, and just in general, people in the community. So I don't want to just like be completely open to everyone in the world. Come show me all your depictions of trans people. But I am perfectly happy for people in good faith. And so in general, DMs on Twitter are generally the best place to reach me, because that's where my most open, trusting, and knowing community is.
Sure. I didn't, pardon me for putting you on the spot. And of course, I'm glad people have you to possibly reach out to. The selfish part of me is also like, please don't take too much of Lily's time. I want to read some more of her work. You sensitivity read for everybody. I'm not going to get as much. What I'm hearing in some of this as you're talking through leads me to my next question, which is, on your books, you offer context warnings. They're not even called trigger warnings. It's just context of things you may come in contact with. And if you're in a position at that current reading time to navigate some of these narratives, Has this always been something that you wanted to include in your work? So I find this happens a lot more in new adult fiction.
Yeah, I feel like it's honestly more of a thing among younger people in general, is that there is a trend more towards labeling these things. And since people often tend to write in their own range, that tends to come out more in young adults, in new adult fiction. But just in general, it's kind of something that I always had around me when developing as a writer. And so it just kind of comes to me naturally. But I've also had people, this sounds weird, but I've had people tell me they did not read my book because of the content warnings. And that made me very happy because I don't want to put that kind of content out in front of someone who is not in a place to read it. So in general, it's just a way of helping my readers and making sure they're comfortable with what they're going into. And I also get to put like little dumb things at the end of my content warnings that make me smile, because, you know, I don't generally take anything in life too seriously. So that's also a bonus.
Because I don't want to give away too many major plot points, since we try to stay a little spoiler free when we talk to authors. But I often see in your work before I read it, you know, but don't worry, there's a point for this to happen, or don't worry, nobody is killed, or don't worry. And it's kind of a reassurance of, I'm placing this here so you can avoid it if it's not right for you. But also, if you're on the fence, here's the nudge to keep going.
Right. Yeah. I mean, generally, the more information I can give without actually like spoiling important plot points, the more information, the better, because, you know, some people might be very sensitive about car crashes, for example, in The Simple Answer, but it was, but no one gets hurt, is what I said in the content warning. And so I figured that was an important qualifier, because people have different feelings and some people will be very sensitive to the whole thing in general and want to back away. And some people are only worried about the absolute worst that might come up. So just to try to give the most information as possible so as to empower the readers to make choices they want about their reading.
Since you brought up The Simple Answer, and since Caitlin's on this call as well, I have to ask. Caitlin is a different genre of music, but J-pop plays a significant little nod here and there in The Simple Answer. Caitlin, you admitted you're a K-pop fan. I can do that, right? I understand these are two very different things, but as somebody who's naive to both of them, can you explain J-pop to me some?
I mean, J-pop is Japanese pop music. It is, it is not nearly the phenomenon that K-pop is. I feel like J-pop was sort of in the vein of K-pop's style of popularity, maybe like 10 years ago. But not nearly as popular, just the same style, but not nearly as popular. And that was sort of my formative music experiences, was listening to J-pop. Listening to J-pop boy bands. I'm going to say it outright. I don't have any shame. It's fine. I was a kid. And so it's just kind of always been a thing for me. J-pop is, it feels like my childhood. It makes me feel comfortable. And it actually did inspire me to learn Japanese and take a semester abroad in Japan in university, which was amazing. If you look at like my music playlists, probably like one third of them are actually J-pop. And so it's a lot of the songs that are in The Simple Answer are songs off of my regular playlists. So it's kind of just, you know, a little bit of self-indulgence.
I love it. I did get the reference to the anime soundtracks. I mean, between my brother and I've got that. I get, we're 100% covered. But I knew better than to go, so Caitlin, Lily, I think, listens to J-pop. And Caitlin would have been like, no, it's not the same thing.
Very much
not the same. And I had very much not the same. And I had my own little mini education in J-pop recently because I had a nerd moment and watched this Korean reality TV show, Produce 48, and they talk a lot about the difference between K-pop and J-pop and specifically how they train and how they create music and create personas. So if anybody wants more info, that's a great place to start. But I'm always so interested when writers put in such specificity in those types of allusions or references to other types of media. And the J-pop details were just so like, just so good. Like it's amazing what sort of like those little details can do to really build the character and build the world that you're creating.
It definitely creates world. And also another point on that same topic is that I wanted Percy to have some serious dad energies, so I just listed all the music that my dad listened to. So all of the music that he listens to are from my dad, so you can thank him for that.
Amazing.
So backtracking for just a second to the simple answer, it is in the Ember Grove world that you've created. Yeah. Is this something that we're going to get many more books with, a few more things, a nod here and there? Can we ask?
I mean, you can ask and I will answer as well as I know myself, but okay. I definitely do want to do more books in the setting. The book that I'm working on right now is not in the Ember Grove setting. I was planning to write one. Then I sat down and started writing and something else happened. So I'm like, oh, all right, I guess, sure. But it is definitely, I think a lot of lesbian authors, and generally just probably a lot of authors who write a lot of books tend to like putting nods to other of their books in one book or another. It is part of what I do is just insert references. So you can definitely expect to see references to the Ember Grove world in other books. But I am hoping to ideally create a good number of other books in the Ember Grove series.
I'm super excited. Also, early congratulations, happy anniversary, but the 1 year anniversary of the Christmas ball is coming up. So that's all, like, yay. Like, I mean, I feel so the benefit to discovering artists after they've published a few, get to like really sit with them for a while. So by the time I really took on to who you were, I had 4 things to read, but now I'm catching up. So I'm that annoying thing of a reader with like, why can't you write faster? Why can't you publish faster? It's not like, you know, I can't read somebody else's words. I need yours again. How does it feel coming up on a 1 year anniversary of this first gift that you gave so many of us to enjoy?
I mean, it feels bizarre. Like, partly because 2020 was ridiculous. And I'm not sure if it feels more like it was yesterday or if it was 50 years ago. But also just like how much things have changed over the past year. Like this time last year, I didn't know if anyone was going to buy the Christmas ball and if I would have to, because right now I was in the pre-order period this time last year for the Christmas ball. I had no idea if it was going to gain any traction and if it was going to get me anywhere. So I was fully prepared for the book to completely fall through and to just like, because I had been writing for 9 years before now. I had been writing for 8 years by then and publishing other books for 1 year before that and all to no avail. So I was perfectly expecting, or I don't know about expecting, I didn't know what to expect. I was perfectly prepared for the Christmas ball to fail completely and for me to find something else to do and with my writing and with my life. And so comparing now to where I was a year ago, now where I am making a living full time by writing books, like this is my dream life ever since I was a kid. And I just get to wake up and do it every day. And it's surreal and it's beautiful, but it's honestly just sometimes hard to wrap my head around. Like I'm really young. I'm only 26. And if all of this happened in the past 1 year, I don't know. I guess I'm going to be really cool in like 10 years. Like, watch, in 10 years, I will be like some kind of internationally best-selling, super famous top lister author. And this podcast right here is going to be famous because it's my first interview.
We will keep paying our monthly RSS feed so we can just make sure that this is here as an archive work. If we got to talk to you before, it was impossible to get you down for an interview.
Yes, before I pushed Stephen King over in terms of this, you know.
Except well, and he deserves to get pushed over. So I am here to aid in whatever needs to happen to make this reality happen.
Congratulations on being recognized for your hard work. I mean, like, just, I'm so glad that's happening for you. And I'm so glad that, you know, all your hard work has manifested into an audience who's able to enjoy that work. And I think your personality and your kindness of it, I believe it is sincerely you and not a marketing ploy, but also what a genius way to market through kindness instead of threatening people to read your work. And you just show it can work without it being super aggressive, which so often it does feel like it's a rat race and only one or two people can make it. And you know, your energy very much is, you know, rising tides lift all ships. And I'm super humbled by you in that all the time. And I find a lot of authors because of you and who you lift up. So thank you.
I feel like I don't actually know how to respond to any of your compliments because thank you doesn't feel like enough. So I just like, do I say it like 4 times?
We like to sort of wrap up with, what are you, like, what kind of media are you consuming right now? Can you read? Have you been able to watch TV? Are you listening to music? Like, what are you surrounding yourself with as you are trying to create your own works right now?
So I kind of have 2 modes of existence. One is where I'm trying to get a book to work, and one is where a book is working. So In the times where I'm trying to get a book to work, I'll typically write like maybe 3,000 to 5,000 words a day, which is still a lot, I guess, but a lot of it goes to the trash can. So I typically write that much, and I will consume a lot of media, you know, a lot of romance novels and romance movies, and just trying to immerse myself in the genre as much as possible. And then every now and then I will get into the point where I have a book that is working. And during that time, I don't do anything other than write books and sleep every now and then. So that's where I am right now, actually. So I have not like thought about anything other than my book for like a week. So it's a pretty cool way to live. It's also a little bit intense.
Lily, I really appreciate you talking to both of us. Caitlin, I feel it's okay to speak for you in this moment. Like, this is just... this is a wonderful joy, and I'm hoping part 2 will happen before, you know, you're just impossible to get to through your agent. I have about 6.5 to, I have like 6.5 to 8 years before it's almost absolutely impossible. Hopefully it's much, much sooner than that. Besides Caitlin and I, who get to geek out with you now here, is there a way for people to find you and speak to you and learn more about your work elsewhere? And if so, where?
Twitter is the best place. If I don't exist on Twitter, then I don't exist anywhere. And it's probably a sign that I am in one of the states where my book is working. And follow me on Lily Seabrook. Pretty sure Rebecca and Caitlin have a link for this.
It will be hyperlinked in the show notes, everybody. Just grab it. Or watch me, you know, on my own Twitter feed, tagging Lily everywhere this week.
Of course.
It would be easy to get to her.
She's going to make me feel famous.
Lily, thank you so much. This has been, I think I'm echoing Rebecca here, it's just such a joy and such a balm for me. You know, I feel like your like sparkle and your just energy, even through like Skype or through this recording device, have just been so amazing. So thank you so much for sharing that with the two of us and with all of our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.